Shrink Wrap Radio Number 339, Infant Research and Neuroscience Implications for Psychotherapy, with Judith Rustin.
Shrink Wrap Radio. All the psychology you need to know, and just enough to make it dangerous. It's all in your head. And now here's your host, Dr. Dave.
My guest today is psychoanalyst Judith Rustin, and we'll be discussing the implications of her work in infant research and neuroscience for psychotherapy. Judith Rustin, LCSW, is a faculty member and supervising psychoanalyst at the Institute for the Psychoanalytic Study of Subjectivity in New York City, the Psychoanalytic Psychotherapy Study Center in New York City as well, and the Chinese American Psychoanalytic Association. She has lectured nationally and internationally and published scholarly papers on self-psychology, intersubjectivity systems theory, and more recently, the interface of infant research and neuroscience with these two psychoanalytic theories. Her published scholarly papers cover the same subjects and areas of expertise, with particular emphasis on their application to the therapeutic dyad and the clinical process. Prior to becoming a psychoanalyst, Judith was an assistant professor, field faculty, at the Columbia University School of Social Work. During that tenure, she helped to develop a program that integrated disabled students on a college campus and develop models of programs to ensure permanency planning for children. Currently, she maintains a private practice in New York City. Now, here's the interview. Judith Rustin, welcome to Shrink Wrap Radio.
Thank you. I'm glad to be here and glad to be talking with you.
Well, I am very glad to be talking to you because I keep running across your name. I've been doing a lot of neuroscience-related interviews, and you're one of the people who always gets cited. So I feel very honored to speak to you. And we're going to be focusing on your book that just came out. It's a 2013 book, Infant Research in Neuroscience at Work in Psychotherapy. And at first blush, the title of your book, Infant Research in Neuroscience and Work in Psychotherapy, seems like a rather unexpected conjunction of ideas and domains. Tell us about your first glimmer of the interrelationship between these domains.
Well, it actually derived from my interest in infant research and applying infant research to clinical practice. The infant research that I began to study and learn about really derives from Daniel Stern, Beatrice Beebe with her collaborators Joe Jaffe and Frank Lockman. And the infant research that they do really focuses on face-to-face play in infant-mother interactions. So I really began to get interested in that as a theory of interaction. What goes on between the infant and the mother interactively that really cannot be spoken in words, because infants don't yet have language and infants don't have the capacity for symbolic thinking, which is symbolic thinking having to do with memory, with what we usually think of as memory, where you recall, oh, you know, when I was 3 months old, I cried when my mother went away. Infants don't have that kind of memory.
Right.
So I got very interested, and yet we know that those very early experiences become templates of self with other that endure throughout the lifespan.
Yes, and we'll get into that more. I think we're going to be talking a little bit more about memory as we go along. Let me ask you, what was your purpose in writing this book? Who did you have in mind as your audience?
all psychodynamics, psychotherapy clinicians, whether working from a dynamic psychotherapy point of view, whether working from a psychoanalytic point of view, whether working from a dance therapy point of view, people who work in a clinical situation and who are interested in interaction between two people and how that interaction has a therapeutic effect and an effect to change things for the better.
Yes.
It was for all of the above.
Okay. Now, one of the things I really like about your book is that it's laced liberally with case history stories from your practice. I hope that you can do the same thing here in our discussion. If any case examples or amalgams of cases come to mind, feel free to sprinkle those in at will.
I will do my best. The case examples in the book are amalgams. They're usually two or three, sometimes more, people put together. So that usually requires a certain amount of tweaking and thought.
Sure.
In terms of usually what comes to mind when I'm speaking extemporaneously are people from my current practice. So I do have to be careful to not, you know, if I can do it quickly and think of an amalgam or think about something from the past, I will do it or make something up quickly. I can do that too. But it's a little stingy in that regard. You'll understand.
Yeah, sure. Of course, you've got to observe confidentiality. Right. Now, in the book, you talk about your own personal development and movement through psychodynamic therapy, starting with ego psychology and then moving into the psychology of Heinz Kohut and self-psychology, and then later to intersubjectivity theory of Robert Stolarow, is that
and collaborators. He has three collaborators, major collaborators. He's done almost all of his work with George Atwood, Bernie Brandschaft. Those were the three people that I studied with. And Donna Orange has been a more recent addition to collaborating with him on the theory of intersubjectivity dynamic systems theory.
Okay, well, I'm not sure that all my listeners are going to be familiar with those, and I'm sure that if you were to go deeply into them, it would take a long, long time that we're not going to have. I was least familiar with the intersubjectivity theory, so that one you might dwell on a little bit more than the other two. But maybe you can take us through those three major epochs in your own theoretical development.
Okay, well, I began my career in the late 1960s, and ego psychology was the only show in town those days. I began as a clinical social worker at the Mount Sinai Hospital here in New York in their adult psychiatry department, and most of the attending faculty who were also the people who trained the residents were from New York Psychoanalytic Institute, and that was the bastion of ego psychology here in New York. And I was very fortunate. It was an enormously rich training environment, and we were all allowed to participate in the training that the residents had. We were able to participate as well. So I really became steeped in that tradition.
Well, what is ego psychology? I mean, it's an elaboration of, it somehow goes past Freud's original ideas. How would you characterize the heart of the approach of
well,
ego psychology?
Really, I would think about it as the use of the Freudian structural model of the mind. That's, I think, what is meant by ego psychology, the structural model of the mind, where you have three, the ego, the id, the superego, all of which are organized around managing of the basic drives.
And so then you moved on from there to the self-psychology of Heinz Kohut. How is that different? What does that bring to the party that wasn't there before?
Well, in the interim, when I left Mount Sinai, I moved to the Columbia School of Social Work, and I was involved primarily in training social work students. And it was during that period of time that the shift began to occur. So the Columbia School of Social Work revamped their whole curriculum from an ego-psychological approach to an ecosystems approach. In other words, that we are all embedded in a social, cultural, familial system, and that is what is influencing one's behavior, development, etc. And I really became much more involved in teaching and training students from that perspective. When I picked up again doing private clinical work myself, it was in the late 70s, and that's when Heinz Kohut's ideas about the psychology of the self had really started to take hold. And in some ways, it was a reaction to the ego-psychological approach, in that he viewed the primary motivation in life was not one centered around the drives, but rather one centered around the development of the self. I don't know quite how to explain the development of the self other than how we experience ourselves at any given moment in time. And that was the primary motivation that we all have as infants, children, etc. We are always trying to protect our own senses of self so that it has an opportunity to be expressed in life, in the world, in our relationships.
Okay, well, speaking of relationships, then you move along to the concept of intersubjectivity, which became especially key to your clinical work. So tell us about intersubjectivity and how that changed things for you.
Well, certainly it was partly an outgrowth of Heinz Kohut's psychology of the self and partly developed in parallel too. It did more of an integration in that the theory itself encapsulated both. It encapsulated both the development of the self, or what Stallaro and collaborators call developmental needs, as well as some of the aspects of ego psychology, namely, we not only are trying to express our most authentic selves, but often what stands in the way are internalized relationships that make it difficult for us to do. So that was part of it. But I think the thing that, and I've certainly integrated all of that into my thinking, but the Atwood Stallaro Branshaw view was that the self or the person always exists within a system, in a two-person system. And it is that system that is the unit of inquiry and study. So if you apply it to the patient-therapist dyad, what you're always looking at is how am I influencing the patient and how is the patient influencing me and how can we understand how those two things are working with each other.
Yes, and that made a lot of sense to me. I originally was trained in the psychoanalytic perspective myself and was somewhat rebellious and ended up being very influenced by the humanistic psychology movement. And so that whole idea of really focusing on the dynamic relationship between client and therapist from moment to moment, that really resonates strongly with me. So how did you become involved in infant research in the first place?
Well, it was all part of my psychoanalytic training. When I actually was first exposed to it before there was any book written about it when Daniel Stern, this was, again was in the late 60s, he came to a grand rounds. At that point, I was at St. Luke's Hospital. He came to a grand rounds, and he started describing what he was doing in terms of filming infants and mothers. And so I got very interested in that because the infant research that I've been interested in has been the face-to-face play with infants and mothers. And what is done in that kind of research is the infant and the mother are videotaped in a split screen. The infant on one side, the mother on the other side, even though, in fact, they're face-to-face. But when you look at the video, you're looking at one page, one on the left and one on the right. And in the process of doing the videotaping, it can also be slowed down. So you get what's called microanalysis, where you can mm-hmm. see what is happening between the two people much faster than the eye can see. Because you're seeing what you can't see in real time. But if you slow it down, you see very tiny incremental movements.
And I assume our brain picks up on that even though we are not consciously aware of what we're seeing. I'm skipping ahead a little bit, but would that be
true? That's exactly right. Sometimes, I wouldn't even say the brain, I would say the brain body is picking it up. The brain is part of a whole body, and it is just one part of it. But yes, that's exactly right, because it's conveyed in different ways. It's not just visual, it's mm-hmm. oral, it's what you hear, it's state, you know, what the mother's state is, what the infant's state is. It is aroused or is it dampened down? So the videotape shows it all, and you can see it in the microanalysis. And that was how I really got interested in studying this part of infant research.
Well, I think that's one of the things that makes you really distinctive, because I don't think that most psychoanalytic psychotherapists get involved in research at all. And I know that there are some who have, but in the larger picture, I think it's relatively small. Now, you write that I wanted to ask you, in what ways do the ideas in infant research and then the emerging explosion of information coming from neuroscience, how do they relate to one another?
Well, I that was how I actually got interested in the neuroscience. I actually got interested in it through the infant research. I was a convert. I believed it. I believed it. It informs a theory of interaction between all people, but certainly in the more intimate relationships. And, okay, the infant doesn't have a symbolic capacity until people put it at different time, anywhere between 1 to 3 years. So what happens with all of those memories? And that was what really got me interested in the neuroscience part. First, I started to study about memory. I learned all about implicit memory and procedural memory. And I said, oh, there it is. That's how things get encoded.
Now, you write that you became a convert, but you write that there's a significant portion of the psychoanalytic community that is either skeptical or that outright rejects the application of neuroscience to clinical practice, arguing that it's reductionistic. So tell us a bit about that resistance and how you are personally able to overcome it for yourself.
Well, it's very much like the infant research and the face-to-face play. When I first started working, I studied a lot with Beatrice Beebe. I don't do the research myself, but I'm very informed by her research, her videotapes. When that first started getting applied to adult psychoanalytic practice, there was the same kind of somewhat dismissive response. Oh, patients aren't infants, and therapists, analysts aren't mothers, so, you know, this doesn't apply. But that has changed dramatically, because we're talking more in the 80s that was a sort of dismissive response. There has been the same response initially to applying neuroscience to psychoanalytic or psychotherapeutic work. And it goes something like this: you cannot reduce mind to brain. And, you know, to some degree, that's true. But mind is embodied, and the brain is part of the body. So to try and just dismiss it as reductionistic or irrelevant doesn't make sense to me. And it has changed. I mean, I started working with this in the mid-90s, I would say, and things have really changed a lot. More and more people are interested in this. They're more and more interested in learning about the brain and neuroscience and how it does inform mind and how we can use it in the clinical endeavor. But, you know, I hear that a lot, again, about it's reductionistic or it's dangerous, and we should
dangerous.
Right. Well, I think that comes more from perhaps some of the misuse of neuroscience in advertising. You know, you put somebody in an fMRI machine, and their brain lights up, and you say, "Oh, see, they like my product." There's a misuse of it. But frankly, it's like arguing about, you know, which is the real religion, Catholic or Jewish, or, you know, which is the real politics, liberal progressivism or conservative Tea Party. I try not to get involved in those conversations.
Okay. Now, you're pretty clear, though, that this integration of infant research and neuroscience does not lead you to a specific set of techniques for psychotherapy, so that there's no sort of neuroscience psychotherapy. Rather, if it's not that, how does this inform your practice?
Well, first of all, the whole idea that mind is embodied, you know, the brain is only one part of the body, but
yes,
but
yeah.
Mind is, it evolves from a body, and the brain is part of that body. So what it has done is it has made me much more alert to the body and asking questions about it. For example, patients often have trouble struggling to describe what they feel about something. And I will say, well, tell me what's going on in your body right now. And that becomes a pathway for them to describe essentially what their emotional response is. So I can say to them, oh, that's what it feels. Well, all of those things that you're describing are part of anxiety. It's about the emotion of anxiety. Or if it doesn't fall into such a category, I will use it metaphorically. So a patient might say, I'm feeling my arms are getting I'm very aware of my arms. And, you know, I'll ask them to describe it a little bit more fully. And so what I might eventually get to is, oh, I'm feeling when you describe that maybe you're trying to hold back punching something. So it becomes a pathway and a portal for getting at more at emotions and at feelings that might be harder for the patient or the person to describe. That's the way I use it.
Yeah, one thing that comes to mind is that there are quite a few other approaches to psychotherapy that also focus on the body. There are a whole range of body therapies. There's gestalt therapy, which would call particular attention. So it's interesting to hear that kind of focus, that key insight that you're talking about, really has popped up in other places, in other theoretical approaches as well.
I'm sure. But I only use it as one dimension. It does not replace the traditional psychodynamic interpretive work. I might go from there to understanding why it's hard for this person to own their angry feelings. In other words, then begin an exploration psychodynamically about what in their past experience has made it hard or what makes it hard for them with me.
Okay, now I gather one of the key areas that infant research sheds light on is the role of self and mutual regulation. That's something that you explore in some detail. Perhaps you can give us an overview here.
Okay. Again, first of all, let me say to begin with that self and mutual regulation is the terminology of that comes from it's called a dyadic systems model, and it's B.B., Jaffe, and Lockman. That's the way they describe it. There are many okay. other, infant researchers who basically are describing a similar thing, but they use different language. So self and mutual regulation is derived from B.B., Jaffe, and Lockman, and it's really how the system of infant and mother operates in a bidirectional way. So each person of the dyad has to regulate herself, her own state of arousal. The emotional state and the state of arousal often go hand in hand. Each one has to self-regulate, and each one is simultaneously trying to influence the other in order to keep oneself in a state of optimum arousal. In other words, not too much, not too little. And, it's a reciprocal, bidirectional, co-constructed process. In other words, I don't know if I'm explaining it.
I think you are. And, of course, and right now you're talking about mother and infant, but you also apply that to psychotherapy and the clinical dyad between therapist and client. This would be a good place if you do have a way of illustrating that with a clinical example. I don't know if you do, but this might be a good place to throw that
okay,
in.
Okay, so yeah, I'll give you a general idea of how I would do it. When sitting with a patient who might be very anxious and agitated, and they feel very aroused, over aroused, they're very uncomfortable. So they are communicating to me a sense of anxiety, agitation, over arousal. I will respond by trying to dampen myself down. So, and again, you do these things non-consciously. You're not always aware of it, but then at some point you do become aware of it. I notice that I'm sitting more quietly and my voice drops and it gets slower. So, I will notice this in myself as mm-hmm. I am sitting with a person who is anxious, agitated, and over aroused. So I want to give them space to calm down. And I do it by dampening myself down and slowing myself down. So they're influencing me, And I am trying to influence them simultaneously. And this all happens out of awareness of both partners, unless as the therapist you try to make yourself aware of it, which I do try to do.
Yes. Now, speaking of awareness, I'm particularly interested in your observations on memory. And of course, Freud talked about unconscious memories from childhood influencing our, you know, later life. Concepts of procedural and implicit memory that you referred to earlier have really fleshed that out, haven't
yes.
they? And I gather that research supports the idea that the early experiences of infancy lay down memories that can influence us throughout our lifespan, even though we may not be consciously able to access them. So maybe you could take us a little bit through the various kinds of unconsciousness. So you talk about the unconscious and non-conscious.
Right.
Take us through that.
Okay. So, you know, when Freud was talking about memories, he was talking about what we now, in the language of what we now know about memory, explicit memory. And this is memory that requires the capacity for symbolic thinking. In other words, you have to be able to symbolize an experience in order to have a conscious memory of it at some point. You know, when he talked about repressed memory, he's talking about memory that had been conscious and explicit and then gets repressed. Implicit memory is non-conscious. It can be non-conscious. Sometimes it's non-conscious. Sometimes it has had an explicit form and then is repressed. But I tend to leave non-conscious memory for those very early memories that never formed explicitly. They are implicit. And they are procedural, meaning they're held in the body. Infants are born with the capacity to remember procedures. Procedures meaning I do this, mother does that. I move this way, mother moves that way. The memory is in the movement. In the procedural, it's actually the basal ganglia that encodes that kind of memory. That's movement memory. And there's no explicit conscious memory that recalls those things. And I reserve those kinds of implicit, procedural, and emotional memories. Infants also have the capacity for emotional memory, that in certain procedures, they don't remember the emotion, they feel the emotion. It's held in the body. So when something is reminiscent of an early template experience, you can, as an adult, have an emotional memory that occurred years earlier. I just, you know, was reading an article, and I was teaching it about, and this is an analyst who has done a lot of body, you know, she herself had experienced a lot of body work trying to understand what her body, what relational trauma her body held. And somehow in that experience, she went back and asked her mother and learned that there had been a separation, an unanticipated, unintended separation for a period of time when she was 2 weeks old. Well, who would mm-hmm. remember that? But clearly her yeah. body remembered that. And then there was another one, you know, at a certain number of months later. And clearly those abandonment experiences were held in her body and contributed to a lot of of the difficulties she had as an adult. So that's what I mean by emotional memories or procedural memories or non-conscious memories.
Yeah, that's really fascinating. And I know a number of body workers of various stripes have had that experience of in massage or body work, touching a part of the body, and suddenly an emotion will come up. The person might start crying. There's a place where, on my back, where when I'm massaged, where I experience some kind of, hard to describe, but some kind of longing, some kind of sadness, and it's probably just exactly the kind of thing that you're talking about, something that goes way back that I don't have specific memories that I can pull up.
Right. I have a similar experience with my back. So interesting, the experience, my back starts to hurt, and I have, and this has been going on, you know, for 30 years. So it's always that my initial response is always the same thing. My initial response is, I'm not up to the task. So, I mean, if you think about the back, you know, you have to stand up straight, and if your back is hurting, you either have to sit in a comfortable position. For me, it translates into, I'm not up to the task.
Yeah, it's like carrying the world on your shoulders.
Exactly. I have no idea where this comes from in my personal history. I really don't, but I have learned to respect it, that when my back starts to hurt, I know I better be investigating in myself what it is that I'm afraid of, that I don't feel up to the task.
Yes. And another thing that came to mind when you were talking about procedural memories, which I think of, and you can tell me if I'm right or wrong here, sort of like complete behavioral routines that are somehow encoded. And as an older adult who's, you know, now having some memory issues, I will find myself, I'll be upstairs and I'll go downstairs to do something. Maybe I go downstairs with the intent of taking my vitamin pills out of the cupboard. And instead, I will find myself looking in the refrigerator or taking out the trash. And it's as if some subroutine that was there, some fairly complex chain of behaviors, got triggered while my mind was, you know, while I was gathering wool in my conscious mind, going down the stairs, and I find myself doing something totally unexpected. Would that be an example of procedural memory?
Exactly. You know, that somehow you find yourself in the same place, and it triggers, you know, you forgot why you went there, but you have the experience of a retrieval cue. Oh, yeah, you know, here's the refrigerator. Good, time to eat. Or, yep, there's the garbage can. Take the garbage out. Yeah, that would be procedural memory. And our very earliest memories are all encoded procedurally. We don't remember the experience. We just, for example, with an intrusive, looming mother, the baby, you know, the mother who looms in and intrudes, so the baby avoids, turns its head away. So that becomes a procedure for an intrusive, looming, annoying person. And some people keep it as is. In other words, they literally just turn away or walk away. Other people, it becomes transformed. So you might not do something so literally in the face of a looming, intrusive, authoritarian person. Instead, you might start cracking jokes. In other words, you do something to avoid the intrusion. And some people keep it literally. They literally walk away or they turn away. And others find, you know, more transformative symbolic ways of expressing the same thing.
Yeah, and I guess these procedural memories or procedural sequences are encoded in a lower level of the brain so that the cortex is not involved in assessing them or planning them, or and that's why they can kind of get triggered by something that's not necessarily thought out.
That's exactly right. Yeah, these procedures are encoded in the subcortical parts of the brain.
You point out that the infant comes into the world with two major parts of the triune brain, which are called the so-called reptilian brain and the limbic or paleomammalian system. But that key parts of the, this was fascinating to me, key parts of the limbic brain have not developed sufficiently to lay down explicit memories.
Right. And that's primarily the hippocampal area, you know, the part of the hippocampal area which is deeply involved in forming explicit memories.
And, you know, you've got a diagram in your brain, a diagram in your book of the brain, and, you know, and lots of books have that those diagrams. But for the first time, I was really struck. I said, wow, that hippocampal area looks really small. It's really tiny. And yet it plays such an important role in all of our
memories. That's exactly right. Yep.
Wow. I guess it's almost like the gatekeeper of memory.
Well, as I understand it, it creates the context and the map, you know, whatever that means, that's the part of the memory, the context, how, where, when things happen. And you need that for explicit memory. Oh, yes, I remember when I was 6 years old and my mother went away on the first day of school. That's the context. And so you need that for memory.
Yes. I was also struck by the paragraphs in which you describe the infant bond with the primary caregiver and the role of what you call face play. And you mentioned face play earlier. And the role in creating that bond and attunement between the two. Recall you wrote a fair amount about research on face play.
Face-to-face play, right.
Yeah. Can you, is there maybe something that stands out in your memory about that research that you could share with us?
Well, it's what I described before in the microanalysis. It's all done face-to-face. In other words, the infant comes into the world hardwired to prefer the human face.
Yeah.
That is...
That's fascinating.
Yeah. Not only the human face, but I forget where I read this. It may have been in one of Stern's books, but any configuration of two dots parallel and then one almost a triangle in a larger space, so you can think about it as the two eyes and the nose in an oval. So infants are pre-programmed to be attracted to the human face.
Yeah, I just got a new granddaughter who is 1 month old, and she just locks on the face.
Uh-huh.
She just stares at the face.
Uh-huh. And does she find it arousing? I mean, usually infants find it, you know, quite arousing. And that's where the face-to-face play comes in, because it is very arousing for the infant, very stimulating for the infant to see the caregiver's face. And so they then look away. They lower their eyes. They turn their head. They break the eye-to-eye contact. And it's how the mother responds to the infant's attempt to dampen down the arousal. That's what not only what creates the bond is the mother's capacity to be attuned to what the infant needs. And so just a few minutes ago, I mentioned the looming mother. So an infant who breaks the gaze for a moment in order to sort of calm down, the intrusive mother will go chasing after the infant, you know, loom in. Oh, come on, baby, look at me. Come, sweet, don't
yeah. see my...
And then the infant becomes more and more and more distressed. But the mother doesn't get, oh, what's the matter? Because the mother is probably feeling it. I mean, this is just pure speculation, but you can imagine that the mother might be feeling, oh, my baby doesn't like me. You know, my baby is rejecting me, et cetera, et cetera. But it's the in that interaction that the bond gets established. Because the baby is not able to regulate itself and needs the primary caregiver as a self-regulating other.
I was interested, you point out that from the very beginning, the infant is able to communicate emotions. For example, the emotion of aversion, and not just through crying. I mean, most of us think of crying, and that's the way that the infant communicates emotion. But you talked about research that actually where in this filming you could see that if the baby didn't like something, turning its head away was one way to communicate that. Are there other ways that the infant communicates emotion, other kinds of emotions?
Well, you mean the turning the head away as expressing aversion?
Yeah, yeah.
Certainly we've all seen babies go rigid and kick their feet, a protest. They're telling you they don't like something. That certainly it can be considered aversive. It could be angry. It could be distress. Certainly they express emotion through crying. Babies have the repertoire of anger, distress, panic. You know, a baby who's wailing is in great distress and maybe some panic, and any turning the head away, losing tonus. You know, sometimes babies will just go limp if they try to turn their, just taking the example of the looming mother that I mentioned before, baby will try all kinds of strategies, turning away, turning the head the other way, kicking. If nothing works, the baby can just lose tonus, you know, just lie there flat. Sort of a way of thinking about it is playing dead, enough. So they have a real repertoire.
That makes me think that could later turn into maybe sort of a passive-aggressive style.
It certainly could. You know, I'll just lie here, do what you want.
Yeah.
It certainly could.
All of this makes me wonder if this research on infants has buttressed attachment theory as developed by Bowlby. Are there ways in which the findings of infant research have refined or modified attachment theory?
I certainly know Bowlby's attachment theory. I know the broad strokes. I know the different attachment styles. I'm hardly an expert on attachment theory. It's like another paradigm.
Yes.
So I can talk object relations, but I don't know the ins and outs. All I would say about it is that all of the infant research probably supports Bowlby's attachment styles, because it's really about how the infant responds to the caregiver's behavior as a self-regulating other. So if anything, I would think that it fleshes it out in some way. But it is a different paradigm.
Yeah, I would think that all of this infant research would do something, either confirm or sharpen some of the ideas. So I'll keep my ear to the ground for information about that.
Well, I just read an article. I mean, it actually just came out in a journal last year, towards the end of 2012, and it was by Beatrice Beebe and a bunch of her collaborators, and it was very interesting in terms of refining the ideas about the D babies, you know, those who have a disorganized attachment style, and in videotaping infants and mothers who later at 4 months, who later at 12 months showed disorganized attachment styles. These infants, the mothers were responding to them in inconsistent ways. So, for example, the baby is very distressed and crying, and the mother is smiling. She may be trying to calm the baby down, but the visual is smiling. So she's giving, whether it's out of her own discomfort, her own, you know, disorganized attachment style, but the baby gets a mixed message. And one of the things that is coded is those babies do less self-touching in response to the mixed message. Well, self-touching is a self-soothing, comforting strategy. And so at 12 months, these babies have fewer strategies for managing distress. Oh, that's not a good thing. We all need strategies for managing distress. And if the template begins at 4 months where you don't have a strategy, you end up feeling helpless and powerless. And powerlessness is one of the primary emotional experiences in relational trauma. The sense of feeling there's nothing I can do. I'm just powerless. So there was a research piece, it was just published a few months ago, that certainly supports, it gives specific data, one aspect of an attachment style, the disorganized attachment style.
Well, thank you for sharing that with us. Do you remember the name of the journal?
Yeah, it's Psychoanalytic Dialogues, 2012. I don't have the volume in front of me.
That's okay. That'll give somebody, if anybody wants to follow up, that's probably enough of a hint for them to chase it down. In your final chapter, you write, and I'm quoting, "The concepts described in this book do not replace any of the old ways of thinking about or doing therapy. They just provide additional pathways for understanding and intervening in a way that offers additional sources of fluidity and elasticity to the therapeutic relationship and clinical process." And I guess you said something like that earlier. It's something that I've heard from a couple of other people that I've interviewed, kind of got the impression that, oh, this is going to change psychotherapy in a major way. But it seems like it's subtler than that. But I wonder if you think that this sort of research that we've been discussing necessitates any changes in the way that psychotherapy is taught.
Yeah, I think that all of this information should be taught along with the different theoretical models of psychotherapy. I think, yeah, people should really learn about how to think about the implicit non-conscious aspects of therapeutic interaction. Patients speak different languages. Some patients speak more with their bodies. Some speak more with their emotions. Some speak more with words. And the first century of psychoanalysis, it was all about explicit words. What we think, what we know, what we remember. And all of this is just adding a way for me of understanding the implicit dimension of what goes on between two people. Much of it goes on out of conscious awareness. You know, you're not aware that you're doing it, but when it enters your, when as it becomes part of your lexicon, you really do become much more aware of it. And both how your patients are communicating and how you're communicating with them.
Well, I think that's a great summary of much of what we've been talking about here. So, Judith Rustin, it's been great to speak with you. And I want to thank you for being my guest today on Shrink Wrap Radio.
Well, thank you very much.
I trust that you found some stimulation and new information in this interview with Judith Rustin. I highly recommend her book to you. Despite touching on such technical issues as infant research, neuroscience, and psychoanalytic theory, it's written with considerable grace. Also, there are a lot more clinical examples in the book than she was able to produce in our relatively brief interview. And there was the additional issue that the case examples in the book were actually composites of different clients that she had worked with over the years. That sort of amalgamation is necessary for maintaining confidentiality and is a standard practice among clinical authors. I think it was hard for her to recall all the details of these made-up cases and at the same time very difficult to make up new amalgamations on the spot. Believe it or not, there's still some major neuroscience authors that I'm hoping to interview in the future. One of them is one that she mentions in her book, and that is Antonio Damasio. I had a question for her concerning what she referred to as his somatic marker hypothesis, but there was not enough time to get to that question. Another person who I've been hoping to interview is Alan Shore. I do have an email address for him that I received from one of my contacts at Norton Books, but I've received no response to my two inquiries. I do have another one lined up with Ian McGilchrist, author of The Master and His Emissary and The Divided Brain and the Search for Meaning. So that should give us all something to look forward to.
I've been doing some hard traveling, I thought you'd know. I've been doing some hard traveling way down the road. With a heavy heart and worried mind, Shrink Wrap Radio's a real good find. I've been doing some hard traveling, Lord. Days been doing some good listening, I thought you'd know. Got the days been podcasting way down the road. With a big fat mic and a soothing voice, you know he's offering you a real good choice. He's been doing some podcasting, Lord. I've been doing some deep traveling, I thought you'd know. I've been doing some deep exploring way down the road. With a happy heart and bright spirit, life's called me, ain't gonna fear it. I've been doing some deep traveling, Lord. I've been doing some wide exploring, I thought you'd know. I've been doing some self-exploring way down the road. With Jung and Freud and soul and psyche, Dr. Dave's in my ear to guide me. We've been doing some wide traveling, Lord.
That was fellow psychologist from Down Under, Dr. James Anderson, once again singing our joint version of Hard Travelin' Shrink Wrap Radio. It may have sounded like a duet, but unlike the version I played last week that had us both singing, in this version he's just overdubbed his own voice for a duet sort of effect. I think this version is easier to understand. Which do you prefer? And if you'd like to add your musical talents to our Shrink Wrap Radio musical library, do drop me an email. Here's another short audio clip.
My name is Grant Strine, and I practice clinical psychology in Havertown, Pennsylvania. After months of listening to Dr. Dave's spectacular interviews and noticing their positive effects in my personal and professional lives, I felt moved to offer a small token of monetary support. Not only did this extinguish any lingering guilt about not supporting, it boosted my mood for days. And I was so happy and pleasantly surprised to get a kind and thoughtful return email from Dr. Dave himself. Now I feel a profound satisfaction for being part of the Shrink Wrap Radio community.
Thank you, Grant Strine, for your tangible financial support. If you haven't done so already, won't you please join Grant? As he suggested, you'll feel really good if you do. I want to let you know about an offer from my Jung platform partner that I think will be sure to interest many of you. Are you a fan of Rumi, the Persian poet? I suspect many of you are. If so, then you may also be familiar with the name Coleman Barks, who has been the principal translator and popularizer of Rumi's poems. I understand he's also a terrific storyteller and reader. I had hoped to interview him, but his schedule is too crowded. However, my listeners will be able to get a 10% discount using my discount code of Dr. Dave, that's D-R-D-A-V-E, on either live viewing or subsequent viewing of a presentation he'll be giving in Salt Lake City on February 28th at 6 p.m. As I say, you can view it live or subsequently get the DVD or stream it for $19.75 minus a 10% discount for using my code of Dr. Dave. Find full details and a link by clicking on the Jung platform graphic in the right-hand sidebar on my site and scrolling to the bottom of that page. Also, if you live in the San Francisco Bay Area, let me mention an event sponsored by the San Francisco Jung Institute. This coming Saturday, February 23rd, 2013, there is a distinguished panel of Jungian analyst speakers, and prices range from $25 to $62 for the day-long event, depending upon whether you're a student and whether you want a box lunch. I'm planning to be there, so if you go, please keep an eye out for me and come up and introduce yourself. Now, I'll put a link to both the Coleman Barks event, where you can use Dr. Dave as a discount code, and I'll also put a link for the Jung Institute event on the opposites in the show notes for this episode, number 339, on the Shrink Wrap Radio site. That should make it real easy to find both. As you know, I've been doing lots of interviews recently with leading neuroscientists. For those of you who enjoy that sort of thing, you'll want to be sure and grab yourself a copy of the March 2013 National Geographic, which is devoted entirely to the brain. It's chock full of beautiful illustrations, as only the National Geographic can do, and it's got lots of exercises you can try out for yourself, plus lots of very short articles, so it's very digestible. By the way, I received no promotional considerations for this mention, just something I thought you'd like to know about. At the same time, however, if you are looking for even more depth, let me remind you of the new 8 continuing education unit course that I just put up on neuroscience and healing. You will find full information about that on the store tab at Shrink Wrap Radio. You might recall my interview with Dr. Kristen Neff on self-compassion that I did sometime back on my WiseCounselPodcast.com series. She recently did a presentation at a TEDx. I think you'll be very inspired by it. Just do a search for her name or for self-compassion on TED.com, and you should be able to find it. I'm happy to announce that we have a new transcript on the site, thanks to listener and volunteer, Gloria Ullman. It's number 335, The Archetypal Couple with Jungian Analyst Tamar Krohn, Ph.D. If you're listening to Shrink Wrap Radio but have not clicked on the subscribe button on whatever software you're using, please do so. It helps me to know how many of you are out there.
Shrink Wrap Radio. All the psychology you need to know, and just enough to make you dangerous.
Thank you, Heather Gout, who will not be my next guest, but I just love her diction. Now, let's listen to a few recent emails from our listener community. First, we hear from Rabbi Zelig Pliskin, who writes from Jerusalem, saying, "Hi, Dr. David. I thank you very much for your wonderful, informative interviews. What motivated me to write you right now is that I'm grateful for your posting Dr. Martin Seligman's talk at the second conference on positive psychology. The idea of post-traumatic growth is a valuable approach. I loved your interview with the author of The Happiness Trap. I have a recommendation for an interview with Lionel Ketchian. He has a website, happinessclub.com. He made a decision to be happy a number of years ago, and he is consistently so. Lionel started the first happiness club in Fairfield, Connecticut. He has a biweekly newsletter about happiness. He is one of the happiest people I have ever met. I personally am the founder and host of the Joy Club of Jerusalem. I wish you tremendous success. And that's from Zalig Pliskin. And that sounds like a very interesting suggestion. I really want to give that serious consideration because it would be a great follow-up on all the interviews that I did on positive psychology, and I really haven't touched base with that in quite a while. Next, we hear from Rob, who writes with another guest recommendation. Dr. Dave, I am a supporter. Great stuff. Here's an idea. I'm just a layperson, but with a curious mind. My other favorite podcast, sorry, I have two, is On Being with Krista Tippett. It would be a total blast if you were to interview her. She is not really a psychologist, but she has spoken with many, not to mention her conversations with the Dalai Lama and various luminaries in many fields. I think the two of you would hit it off, and I can only imagine what you'd come up with to talk about together. Keep up your fab work, please. Best, and that's from Rob. Well, I looked up Krista Tippett and discovered that she has a show on National Public Radio. So she has a lot more support than I do for putting on an excellent show, and it does seem like she is an incredible interviewer. And so I added her to my very long list of listener suggestions. Next, we hear from Matthew, who writes, Hi, Dr. Dave. I'm thrilled to have discovered your podcast. What a valuable service you're doing for humankind. Looking forward to exploring further. I have a BA in psychology, but never got around to further schooling. But nowadays, with the wealth of information available online, all that is needed is a little curiosity and a lot of time. Thanks again for your dedication to sharing your passion for psychology with the world. Warm regards to you, Matthew. Thank you very much for that, Matthew, and I hope you'll keep on listening. And finally, we hear from my friend Oscar in Stockholm, who posted the following comment on my interview with Dr. Lou Cozzolino. What an awesome interview. It was refreshing to hear Dr. Cozzolino's combination of deep expertise and openness/humility. It lessened my resistance to the neuroscience craze. If you read the comments at all, you might have noticed that Oscar had written a critical but important comment on a previous interview about neuroscience, in which he was basically asking, you know, how much does this information really add to what we're doing? A much better worded challenge than that. And as you may recall, I actually read it in the interview with Dr. Cozzolino and had him respond to it. And he did a very good job. So good work, Lou Cozzolino and Oscar Stahl. So I think that better wrap it up for today. We've run pretty long. As always, send your emails to shrink@shrinkwrapradio.com. Remember that in addition to emails, you can also leave comments about individual shows in the comments area on the site. You can leave voicemails on Skype where I'm ShrinkPod, and you can leave voicemail on our phone at 206-350-9918. You can also leave voicemails using our iPhone/Android app, about which you can find full details in the Apps tab on our site. Thanks to today's guest, Judith Rustin, for sharing her fascinating work on infant research and neuroscience implications for psychotherapists. My next guest will be psychiatrist Dr. Ian McGilchrist, and we'll be discussing his groundbreaking and visionary book, The Master and His Emissary, The Divided Brain and the Making of the Western World. So until then, this is Dr. Dave saying, it's all in your mind.
You've been shrink-wrapped by Dr. Dave. All the psychology you need to know, and just enough to make you dangerous.